That was my little four-year-old buddy Everly reading a sign to me in the Sonoma Square. It's a big, bossy sign that reads, "No dogs, no skating, no surfboards, skateboards, I think, no bikes." There's one of these exact same signs on every corner of the square telling people every week about the rules that govern our gorgeous summertime farmers market. And Everly points out every one of those signs to me whenever she's with me at the park. I'm a lot like Everly in that I like to know the rules, and I like to follow them too. I like knowing what's allowed and what's forbidden, and because I'm naturally compliant, people in authority really don't have to worry about me falling out of line. For me, life is simpler that way. But when it comes to other people, other than my husband that is, I do tend to notice when they're breaking the rules or doing things they aren't supposed to be doing, but I don't usually get involved in their situation. For the most part, unless I have a dog in the fight, I don't really have a compulsion to mix in, with my words or with my actions anyway. But I still can't help but notice when there's a blatant disregard for a rule everyone else is obeying. And for me, rule breakers are just making things more difficult for the people around them because now the rulesy people like me are put in this position to judge. Even if they don't want to judge, and I hate that feeling. It just seems so unfair. But last night at the farmer's market, it was an actual dog that started to pull me into the fight of sorts. Luckily, it was just a mental fight with myself, but still, it was such a cute little dog doing the pulling. She was this fawn-colored teacup chihuahua who looked like she'd be friends with my spirit animal, Juanita, the OCD chihuahua who lives inside of me, if that were at all possible. When I first noticed her, the little dog was quietly standing in the middle of a semicircle of people sitting in folding chairs, and she wasn't even making any attempts to sniff or sneak a cracker from a pile of them sitting on a very low picnic table someone in her group had set up. I watched the little dog for a minute, and I heard someone call her Buttercup, which just seemed like the perfect name for such a cute little blondie like her. The whole scene should have been a sweet observation for me, but in the back of my mind, I was actually kind of upset about it. I could actually hear Everly going over the rules in my mind in that moment, and the rules were very clear.
Everly, what are the rules?
Buttercup's family and friends must have believed that the no dog rule doesn't apply to them. After all, their dog is small enough to hide if the market organizers were to walk by. No harm, no foul, right? And Buttercup is very cute. And cute dogs and cute people get more breaks when it comes to the rules, right? Sometimes it does seem that way to me. Now, it would be one thing if Buttercup's people were new to the market scene and were just in from out of town or something. But I've seen every person in that gathering of humans before because they always sit in the same spot with the same low picnic table piled high with snack crackers and open bottles of wine. So ignorance is not an excuse in this case. Of that, I'm certain. So I found myself sitting in my own chair, sipping on a glass of delicious Pinot Noir while this terrible band was absolutely destroying a Linda Ronstadt song. And as the song droned on, I watched Little Buttercup minding her own business, but breaking the rules because for some reason, her friends and family felt like they were the exception to the rules. Hi everyone, it's Sonia Bentley's aunt, and welcome to another episode of Nerd Alert. That opening was from a post on my blog called Dog in the Fight, and ever since I put that one up, my awareness of rule breaking has gotten so much worse. So I felt like maybe it was time for me to explore the topic of rules in one of my episodes. Sometimes I feel like I can see the larger issues at play and the smaller issues in this life, and when it comes to the idea that the rules only apply to other people, who are ugly, or at least maybe have ugly or hyper dogs. That kind of sentiment feels incredibly pervasive to me in the culture in which I live. Just in case you're wondering, I live in a part of the country where certain rules bend more than others, if you know what I mean, which makes things confusing most of the time for people like me. And I wish it didn't bother me so much that Buttercup's friends and family were breaking the park rules, mostly because I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my feelings about such things anymore. The larger issues of blatant rule-breaking are impossible for me to solve, even in my own mind. And the smaller rule-breaking issues make me feel like I'm being petty. But I'm not. I actually just care about the rules. Now, I don't know if I can fully engage in the brother's keeper kind of sentiment in my life, because at the end of the day, I don't always feel like we see each other as loving or concerned siblings in this world of ours. And the fact that I felt so irritated about Buttercup's rule-breaking owners makes me question my motivations if I had decided to say something. I mean, I don't think my heart was all warm and loving toward Buttercup's friends and family that night at the park, even though I can assure you my heart wasn't filled with hate or anything like that. Just annoyance. So what do I do? I already know that as far as it goes with me and how I live my life, I will follow the rules to the best of my ability and whenever it's within my power to do so. But when it comes to the world around me, well, if I do decide to venture in one day and say something to a rule breaker for some compelling reason, I guess I'll do it knowing full well that a dog that doesn't belong to me in any given fight these days may come back to bite me. The name of this episode, which is To Be Fair, is inspired by a phrase I catch myself using all the time. I use it whenever I encounter a situation where someone's made a choice I don't fully understand, but one that seems to put them at odds with me somehow. So I say, well, to be fair, and then I try to empathize with the thinking behind the actions, as if I could possibly know what's going on for someone else. But I adopted this sentiment, I guess you could call it, about 5 years ago after I'd fully come to terms with the fact that my life was officially different than it used to be. When I had a loftier perspective and a cushier reality, I don't think I spent as much time as I do now considering what it would be like to walk in someone else's shoes or trying to imagine how someone else came to a difficult crossroads in life and made a decision I wanted to believe I'd never make. But because I always want to be transparent with you in my podcasts, and because I do want to be fair and even in this episode about rules, I need to point something out to you. I really do care about the rules in life, a lot in fact. But I haven't always followed them very well myself. I got a lot of mistakes and transgressions on my record and in my personal ledger too, and I can't stand the thought of setting a tone in this podcast that makes it sound like I think I'm better than anyone else at following the rules, or that I haven't faltered on occasion in my life, because believe me, I have. Just because rules matter to me the way they do doesn't mean I haven't struggled to keep some of them, and so I want you to know that I'm entering into this topic with a humble and very curious heart so I can better organize my own thoughts about how rule-breaking in our culture has gotten to be so common. All right, now that we've addressed rules in my reality, let's talk about the main word in the title, fair. For me, at least, it's a word that's become kind of loaded because, in my eyes, I think we've watered it down in some kind of an attempt to create an unrealistic level playing field where one doesn't seem to exist. Or, in other cases, I think we've candy-coated the term to force-feed the concept of fairness in a way that I, for one, suspect is a little bogus. But then because of my own life experiences, I can start to believe that real fairness requires some kind of understanding of the backstory. I mean, sometimes a girl can find herself in a ditch she never expected to be in, and splitting hairs over a rule that will keep her down for the count at least makes more sense if you know the whole story behind why she broke the rule, doesn't it? I'm not so sure about that anymore. So lately I've been wondering, is it even possible to be fair? Or is modern life simply too nuanced to be black or white or fair or unfair like I want to believe it used to be? And are rules even meant to be fair? In a way, you can't answer a question about fairness if you don't have some hard and fast rules that everyone can agree on, right? But even when we do agree on a set of rules, at least in theory anyway, sometimes it seems like even those rules can be moved around on a sliding scale, and sometimes those very scales are tipped in favor of some people more than others. So if we collectively agree on a rule that's meant to protect or preserve something we all have a mutual interest in, shouldn't that protection and preservation be something everyone can count on? And how do we even explain rules to our kids these days? I, for one, was really thankful Everly wasn't at the park with me the night that I saw Buttercup, because I don't know how I would have explained that scene to her without straddling that whole do as I say, not as I do reality at play in our world these days. And then what about this? Are the rules in conflict with rule breakers as well as the rule enforcers these days? Sometimes it kind of feels like they are. For me anyway, there was a lot of podcasting fodder to consider for this episode, so I've enjoyed putting this podcast together. But you might be tempted to think I was being lazy in my podcast binging this time around, because both of the nerd alerts I'm about to offer up to you in this episode are produced by the same people. But you'd be wrong to think I didn't listen to a lot of content in search of answers to my questions about the erosions of the rules in this country, because believe me when I tell you, there is so much to say about this topic from a lot of different angles. But I eventually settled on two podcasts. They're both series, and they're both the product of a production company that was founded by the famed journalist, author, and podcaster Malcolm Gladwell. And his production company is called Pushkin Industries. Now, if you've listened to any of my other nerd alerts, then you know that it's time for me to insert one of my imaginary product placement promos into the flow. But instead of featuring one of my favorite products, this time I've decided to talk about Pushkin Industries. When I was only just thinking about creating a podcast for myself, I had a very brief daydream that I pitched a series to Malcolm Gladwell and his team of producers at Pushkin Industries called Elephant in the Room. And in this series, I just got to sit around all day with the people Malcolm attracts and talk about big things that people are afraid to mention in mixed company. But that idea didn't really go anywhere, mostly because I don't know if I'm the right person to lead an elephant-worthy discussion, and because I feel like a podcast where all I do is talk about other podcasts is a way better fit for me right now. But you never know. Anyway, I think what I like the most about the content I've listened to that's produced by Pushkin Industries is the fact that they're asking questions that I already have on my mind, and then they're offering me useful new ways to consider these things, and helping me understand tricky topics too, all while learning a lot about myself in the process. I currently subscribe to Solvable, The Happiness Lab, and Revisionist History, and in a bonus episode I've created to go with this full-length episode, I'm featuring some content from a newer Pushkin Industries podcast called Deep Background with Noah Feldman. It's really good. You could easily call this promo pandering on my part, but if you know me at all, you know it's really not. As with all of my make-believe sponsors, I only ever add them to my podcast because I am a genuine fan. And because podcasts are such a source of joy in my existence in this world, it only makes sense for me to talk about the production company that's making my life so much better. So here's to Pushkin Industries, the curious hybrid storytelling podcast company that always keeps me thinking. Anyway, back to Nerd Alert. The two podcasts I'm going to highlight in this episode were both incredibly useful to me, and they were both packaged so well that they helped me contain my own thoughts in a way that definitely evolved my awareness as well as my questions more productively. And both of these podcasts made me dig so much deeper into my core understanding when it comes to my own personal relationship with the rules, as well as my understanding of how morality can play into the larger conversation. Nerd alert, you've been warned. From the first episode to the last, this Nerd Alert series recommendation felt a little like manna from heaven in terms of the questions I've been working out in my mind when it comes to the rules. It's a podcast called Against the Rules, and it's hands down one of the best series I've listened to in ages. First of all, it's Michael Lewis doing this podcast, and I'm a big fan of his writing. And his charm and excellent explaining skills translated really well, in my opinion, into a podcast. I love to note the excellent descriptive phrasing in his writing, and so it was no surprise that his podcast was peppered with great expressions, too. There's this one phrase in the first minute or so of episode one where he said, "This is a place where brown is an exciting color," which instantly gave his listeners their first understanding of the NBA replay center he was about to enter. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm sorry about that. Let me just take a step back and give you a second to catch up with me if you haven't already binged this awesome series. So far in every Nerd Alert, I've been doing this thing where I borrow some actual words from the podcaster I'm featuring and then mush those words together with my words to help create a synopsis for my listeners. And every time I do this, I do wonder if there's any rule against doing this kind of thing. See, I went to journalism school, and I truly value citations and giving people all of the credit for their spoken and written words, too, so at times I feel like I'm treading on tricky terrain here. And because this episode of Nerd Alert and the podcast I'm featuring are both about rules and how they get trampled on in our culture, I felt I needed to point out the fact that I might be in the wrong for what I'm doing. I sure hope not, but anyway. What I did this time around is transcribe some of the trailer content and then edit it so it'll make sense for my podcast. But let me just say this. You should really listen to this trailer because it's so good and it will totally make you want to listen to this podcast. Well, I guess I should just say this. That's what it did for me. But with great respect and admiration for Michael Lewis, his new podcast, and the producers at Pushkin Industries, here's my recap of Against the Rules. It started with a feeling, some nagging worry about this world we find ourselves in. A world where everyone hates the referee. In this 8-part series, Michael Lewis, the author of The Blind Side, Moneyball, The Big Short, and The Fifth Risk, offers up his very first podcast called Against the Rules. In this season, he's talking to us about all of the poorly refereed corners of life, and he just has some simple, basic questions. Questions about what's happened to our idea of fairness and how rules are at odds with the people they were made to protect in nearly every walk of life. At the onset of this series, here's what Michael Lewis thinks. We still need our referees, someone to make the call, someone to protect us when life's unfair. But these days, it's not easy. So Michael Lewis is going to defend the refs because they can't defend themselves the same way in a world where it often feels like everyone is against the rules. It was no small thing for me to decide which highlights I should pull out for this Nerd Alert because each episode of Against the Rules was really well done. And Michael Lewis did a fantastic job of covering so many angles of how we're at odds with all of life's referees these days. But I loved that he started with basketball. See, I watch a lot of sports with my husband, and over the years, I've picked up just enough knowledge to be a little dangerous. But very recently, I changed my pro allegiance in the NBA from the Golden State Warriors to the New Orleans Pelicans because now I have a dog in that fight. A close friend of mine is directly involved with the New Orleans NBA team, and so I've been paying closer attention to the New Orleans sports franchises as a result. But seriously, you'd have to be walking around with a bag over your head and earplugs shoved into your ear holes to miss all of the refereeing controversy swirling around the New Orleans Saints and the NFL these days. And so I found it so interesting to learn how much time, money, and effort are spent on refereeing the NBA refs. And I'm assuming there's probably some kind of NFL and NHL equivalent out there too. But with so many cameras focused on the court or the field and people in the arenas and at home in their comfy armchairs watching with the best available technologies in the mix, there's simply no room or no reason for human error in sports these days. Yet, there's still this deep-seated belief that human error and favoritism and bias exists when it comes to refereeing the highly lucrative sport of professional basketball. And in a way, the stakes have never been higher. But starting with the NBA refereeing conundrum was a brilliant idea, in my opinion, because it called out this presumption that fairness in sports and in life are pretty much falling victim to the same pressures and the same kinds of reactions. Now, I could go on, and I think you'll absolutely see what I mean when you start listening to this series, but in episode one, there's this non-sports-related segment where Michael Lewis interviews some researchers at Cal Berkeley. And the reason he brought them into the episode about the NBA refs is because he was exploring the idea of how entitlement and elitism plays into the idea of fairness. Here's the premise for the study. Cal Berkeley psychology professor Dacher Keltner and his colleagues were wondering this, quote, "Does this sense of being privileged make you disobey the rules of the road or the laws of the land?" End quote. It's a pretty valid question to ask these days because, whether we want to believe it or not, a simple study at a four-way stop that considered the make and model of every car that came into that intersection reveals that some people in fancy cars tend to believe a stop sign is only a suggestion, not a rule. To me, the inclusion of this study was really, really helpful. Because in this basic, easy-to-see expression, it revealed how certain attitudes about whether or not the rules apply to all of us equally get ingrained into our culture. I really don't want to spoil any part of this series for you, but I can't tell you how revealing that experiment featured in episode one of Against the Rules was for me. As I previously mentioned, the title of this episode came about because when I had more things in my life, I know for certain I treated the world around me differently. My whole attitude was different. And even if I was still a nice person most of the time and I didn't blatantly disregard the rules, I know I had a cushion in my mind that made it easier for me to dismiss certain rules more casually than I do now. Running a stop sign back when money wasn't such a big deal to me was something I'd probably get away with, but even if I didn't and I got a ticket and my insurance rates went up, I could easily take that hit. But nowadays, I could run a stop sign, and I might even get away with it, but the risk is just too much. Because if I didn't get away with it, the hit would be so much harder for me to take. And a hit like that sometimes feels like it could take me down. And so for me, anyway, I'm just better off if I follow all the rules, even if I don't want to, or even if I think the rule might be unfair. I realize now that I've been on both sides of things, entitled people can buy their way around a rule, or pay away the consequences that are intrinsically embedded into the rules, which takes away the sting others feel when they break a rule, and in a way, it gives an entitled person a false sense that the rules simply don't apply to everyone in the same way. And when you pull that attitude back into the NBA example in this episode, you see now how the stars of the game, people like LeBron James or Draymond Green, can afford to get lippy with the ref because the penalties, even when there are fines involved, don't really matter when you're making so much money and when people are screaming in the stands that the call was bogus or unfair. That kind of thing will probably always keep the illusion that the rules aren't fair alive and well in the NBA, no matter how much technology they throw at the problem. Anyway. Before I wrap up this nerd alert about Against the Rules, there are two more points I want to suss out with you. The first one was set in motion after I listened to episode 5 of this series, which is called The Neutral, and this might have been the episode that challenged me the most. Michael introduces us to this fascinating man named Ken Feinberg. First of all, this man's thick Boston accent was totally excellent. And when he talked about how he became one of our country's most important neutral referees, the way he said things like orange when he was talking about the first lawsuit he ever settled between Dow Chemical and Vietnam vets suffering from the effects of Agent Orange made me cling to every word with delighted anticipation. But Ken Feinberg's interview with Michael was riveting and enlightening for me for a lot of other reasons, too, because this man has truly become the most trusted arbiter in our country, and he's successfully mediated nearly every mass casualty victim payout settlement since 1979. And it's kind of baffling how one man could be so good at finding this neutral pathway toward making something that happened in this life that was completely and inexcusably unfair feel like it could have some sort of conclusion to it. The thing that mattered so much to me in this interview was when Ken Feinberg tried to explain something about how he does his job so well. And that's when he mentioned the idea of empathy. He said he doesn't, quote, underestimate the importance of empathy, end quote. Yet he qualified that what empathy means to him is the perception that you're trying to get into that person's shoes and understand the damage they're experiencing in their lives. But for him, it's just about listening, not expressing your empathy, because that can often feel hollow to someone in pain. As I listened to this man unfold his thoughts about how he does what he does, I found myself agreeing with Michael Lewis when he concluded that the reason Ken Feinberg is our most important arbiter isn't because of what he does, but because of who he is. And I realized that all of my efforts to try to be fair to people might be coming from an emotional place inside of me, not from an automatic reaction to just listen to others. My version of empathy often has been more about me and about how I feel, yet in reality, I really can't know how it feels to be someone else. Those feelings belong to them, and maybe it's not my job or even my right to assume I understand the way someone else feels. Now, I know I can always listen more, and I can always find ways to empathize, but when it comes to a neutral acceptance of the rules can't be altered or adjusted just because of an emotional understanding of fairness gumming up the works. The rules are still meaningful and in place for a good reason, even though the backstory of a rule breaker still matters. So, I guess I'm left with this idea to ponder. If I really want to be fair, then the rules have to be my most important guide. The final thing I want to express in my recap of the Against the Rules podcast is something that my dad used to call taking your lumps. It was a concept that I figure other people my age or maybe older probably heard from their dads too, because a couple of generations ago, we didn't grow up with parents who portrayed a world that was supposed to be fair. In fact, it was kind of a thing to be reminded that the world isn't fair. But I was an athlete growing up, and so many of my best life lessons came from my experiences with sports, and my dad's constant emphasis on good sportsmanship and overcoming unfairness with my dogged determination or my willingness to dig deeper than other people were the ideals that kind of stuck with me. As a result, I've always loved underdog movies. Rocky, Remember the Titans, The Karate Kid. For me, those are some of the best sports movies because I guess in a way, I've always related to the overcoming of the odds and the sweetness of the victory when you do. But ever since fairness has become such an obsession in every part of American life, I often feel like I'm somehow tone deaf or something when I channel my inner dad voice and think that maybe some people should be more willing to take their lumps. And I'm so sorry if that offends anyone out there, but this culture of victims is in my face a lot, and while I really don't mean to be judgy or lacking in empathy for the story of others, I do find it exhausting at times to spend so much effort bending the rules around people's feelings to somehow deliver on this false expectation that the rules are meant to be fair. In my own adult life, I've had to take my lumps, and it's not fun. And sometimes I've really wished I could figure out how to make certain unfair things that have happened to me right in my eyes, but after a while, I realize that's just a waste of energy. One of my absolute favorite Michael Lewis statements in this podcast came after he was summing up a law professor who was critical of Ken Feinberg's brand of arbitration. After this guy made a fairly clear but very dispassionate comment about how things get so mixed up when the letter of the law is challenged, Michael said this. Quote, I love this idea that the only reason the legal system works is because people don't pay attention to it. Yet when they do pay attention to it, they're shocked by its unfairness. that the stability of the entire society depends on people not looking too closely at its foundation, because when they do, they get seriously pissed off. That feels kind of relevant to me, because I often don't really think about a rule or how it applies to me until I'm in the crosshairs of the consequences, and then suddenly I have all sorts of opinions. But the way I see all of this after thinking about it so much is that I do think rules are important. And while I sincerely don't believe we should keep our heads in the sand and never bother to really consider the rules or be so naive about rule breakers like Wall Street executives who've managed to extort us because of our ignorance, I think this hyper-vigilant focus on the idea of the fairness of certain kinds of rules can mislead us. For me, rules give us order and structure, and they spell out the consequences we can expect when a rule isn't followed, whether we pay attention to that or not. But these days, if I choose to, I can scrutinize and adjust my focus on nearly every single thing in our world. And now, a possible toe on the line when a 3-point shot is made at the buzzer stops the whole game for a replay analysis, versus allowing the call in the court to stand so the underdog can find a way to overcome. Anyway. This episode about the Against the Rules series really helped me examine my relationship to the concept of fairness and how the refs often play an undervalued but clearly necessary role in this world. But my biggest speed bump when I'm trying to organize my thoughts about the rules and about fairness and about how much empathy I should have or shouldn't have for other people pretty much comes down to one word for me: morality. How can a country like ours rely on any kind of collectively held moral compass to guide people toward the good rules that make things more fair and away from the bad ones that seem to make things unfair, when no one seems to have the same moral setting for true north? I struggle with this a lot because I have a very strong set of moral values based on my faith, and even though I'm just like everyone else in this world when it comes to being tempted to only think about myself or my perspectives when I'm charting a path forward in my life, as an American, I really do want to figure out how rules and morality can coexist productively in a nation that disagrees on so many morally based issues these days. And that adds a whole other wrinkle to the mix, because when we can't collectively agree on the rules that end up creating our laws, then factions start to form inside of our culture, and people begin to align themselves into these polarizing groups. And suddenly, rules and laws and how our country should or shouldn't handle things start to get very noisy. And when things get really noisy, rule enforcers get caught up in the fray too, and then everything gets so darn tricky to figure out. But what I've learned is there really isn't only one way to approach this messy collision of rules and morality in our culture. In fact, there might simply be too many for one person to honestly consider. And so the number of podcasts I listen to give me some much-needed context about the rules and fairness in this world of ours really only confused me all the more. But eventually I came across a 3-part series on a podcast that I already listened to. And the way the first episode in this mini-series examined a singular concept from soup to nuts was incredibly interesting to me. But what made it so useful was how in the following 2 episodes, the takeaways from the first episode were applied to vastly different issues taking shape in our country. And that helped me see one example of how to apply moral reasoning to multiple realities that don't seem to have a lot of hopeful answers in the mix these days.
Nerd alert! You've been warned.
So now for my second nerd alert. I want to tell you about a 3-part series from one of my favorite podcasts, Revisionist History. It's Malcolm Gladwell's series where he looks back on the past and helps his listeners discover something that was overlooked or misinterpreted. I totally love that concept. But what I always appreciate about Malcolm's approach throughout all 4 seasons of his podcast series is his curiosity. And even though they say that curiosity killed the cat, and I've already told you I'm prepared to get bitten by the dog I don't have in the fight, both of those household pet cautionary cliches are not stopping me from forging ahead in my quest for understanding about how rules and moral issues in our culture can be better examined. So the three-part miniseries I want to highlight in this Nerd Alert is from Season 4 of Revisionist History, and it includes Episodes 5, 6, and 7. And just like Michael Lewis did in the Against the Rules series, Malcolm starts his examination of this morally-based reality check with a sports example. So, to give you a better feel, here's a direct quote of the show notes for the first episode of this three-part series. In Season 4, Episode 5, which is called The Standard Case, Revisionist History tries to make sense of the conundrum of PED use in baseball using the 500-year-old philosophical techniques of St. Ignatius. This is part one of a three-part series on the moral reasoning of the Jesuit order. After I finished listening to this episode on one of my hikes, I rushed home and downloaded episodes 6 and 7, and after I listened to both of those, I spent some time studying the concept of casuistry, because that was the kind of moral reasoning Malcolm was applying to multiple collisions and so-called conundrums in our midst, where morality and rules and an ever-changing world are in desperate need of some new answers. But let me back it up a little bit. For the sake of my podcast, let me explain that casuistry comes from the Jesuit order of the Catholic Church, which is the part of the Catholic Church that's the keeper, if you will, of education. And 500 years ago, the Jesuits came up with this useful and clearly defined method for solving problems that were new to this world, which Malcolm refers to as novel problems. And what novel problems basically amount to is this moment in time where a new problem surfaces in our awareness that creates a conflict in our understanding or a challenge to the very principles that we believe. And when that happens, suddenly there's a need to find a way to fairly and morally consider all of the new variables in the mix. When this kind of thing happened to a Jesuit more than 500 years ago, the solution to the problem was the application of the moral reasoning method called casuistry. Casuistry is the method of placing the particulars of a situation over the principles in an effort to reframe the problem in a new way. Now, I want to directly quote Malcolm here because I simply couldn't say anything about this topic better than he does in this episode. So, here goes. Quote, "I have to admit that I've fallen in love with casuistry. In this episode and the two that follow, I want to explain the beauty and the power of the casuistic method. It can help with life and death issues and help us resolve some of our most divisive controversies, but also smaller things as well," end quote. And then later Malcolm adds, quote, "Casuistry reframes the problem. And it says there's a way to make sense of difficult problems without retreating into the trenches of principle," end quote. I really like how he explains all this, but it really helped me to understand the history behind the concept of casuistry in this first episode. And then when Malcolm applied this method of sussing out the moral specifics in his first example, which was the Major League Baseball case of Andy Pettit and his use of PEDs by contrasting it to the PED case of Barry Bonds. And by doing this, Malcolm managed to very practically reveal this new kind of thinking and understanding for me. I know I always say this, but it's the truth. I don't want to spoil any of the podcasts I mentioned on my show because they're always so good. But in this case, I can say with so much conviction that if you spend 130 minutes of your life listening to this three-part series, you'll see how empowering the idea of casuistry can be when you're sincerely trying to unpack the complicated issues of our day. Malcolm goes on to apply this moral reasoning method in episodes 6 and 7, first to a Catholic doctor who was a pioneer in the development of the birth control pill, even though that reality was in direct conflict with the longstanding principles of the Catholic Church. And he also uses this method to explore the reality of police-involved shootings in this modern era, which is such a tricky and completely morally complicated part of American life these days. But I was so fascinated by how the casuistic method was applied to these real-world events in my awareness that seemed to have no answers and no common ground between the two sides of people who are shouting about them. And what I admired the most about the application of casuistry to a polarizing problem was how it could effectively move what I think of as a moral issue away from the political juggernaut that it usually becomes. And I appreciated how in all three episodes, I was provided with such a wide application of casuistry and the moral reasoning it encompasses, and how that can be applied to a variety of modern-day examples. And for me, this offered up a different way to process what I sincerely feel are the conflicts that are eroding the infrastructure of our trust in the rules, as well as our trust in the rule enforcers. By listening to this podcast, Malcolm started to teach me how casuistry is basically descending into the particulars, or in other words, taking a deeper dive into a new variable that appears in the mix, and then setting aside the principles so you can actually engage in the specifics of the case in question. But in episode 7, Malcolm offers up the real cherry on top of all of this kind of thinking for me. That's the concept of disordered attachments, which St. Ignatius explains as the kind of mental reasoning that gets in the way and keeps us as human beings from being open-minded enough to consider truth from all sides. And in my own words, disordered attachment is this kind of digging in of our heels simply because we've grown so close-minded in our personal morality and beliefs in life, which prevents us from ever seeking a greater kind of truth or understanding about the ever-changing world around us. Now, Malcolm ends up using a pretty big controversy to express how disordered attachments play out in one of the most notorious controversies in recent years, the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. A deeper dive into that case revealed that the real undercurrents that were roiling beneath the surface of that horrible case were not about one side being right and the other side being wrong. Rather, it was all about the various disordered attachments that the two primary sides had and wouldn't let go of, but were actually the result of a problem no one was even looking at. And this deeper look at things revealed that both sides were right and both sides were wrong. Because when the only way you're considering a situation is through the disordered attachments people have to a controversy, there's no room for truth to prevail. I listened to all three of these revisionist history episodes several times because there's a lot to unpack in there, and because there was so much valuable information for me to learn when it comes to how I can better approach divisive arguments in our culture as well as how I can orient myself to the rules and the rule enforcers. But I have two final takeaways from this three-part series that have kind of become this important moral compass, if you will, that I want to start using in my own life. There's this really great interview that Malcolm does at the very end of the first episode of this mini-series, which, as a reminder, is season 4, episode 5 of Revisionist History. But this interview is with a Jesuit priest named James Martin. James is the editor of the Jesuit magazine called America, and in this interview, James kind of broke my heart while also proving to me the value of examining the particulars over the principles when a deeply nuanced and morally integrated tragedy occurs in our country. Again, to preserve the value and the beauty of this interview and the integrity of this episode of Revisionist History, I will keep my comments a bit vague, but in an effort to explain how casuistry plays into the modern era and can even run into direct conflict with a moral heavyweight institution like the Catholic Church, James Martin tells Malcolm about writing an article in his magazine about the Catholic Church's decision to put principle over the particulars in the aftermath of the shooting that took place at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Because that nightclub was a gay club, the church decided not to send out a statement of comfort or solidarity with the victims and their surviving family because homosexuality is at odds with the principles of the Catholic faith. You really need to listen to the answer James gave about how he sorted his feelings and the particulars in his understanding because it was pretty awesome. And it perfectly illustrated the profound value of casuistry for me. James didn't have to trash the principles of the church to make his point. You just had to start that heartfelt descent into the particulars, and that exploration was deeply moving to me. For me, this kind of conflict between the particulars and the principles is where I did some of my most important thinking. And it's also where the combination of listening to the Against the Rules series and this three-part revisionist history content intersected in a way that forced me to pump the brakes. So, to wrap things up, I feel like the Against the Rules series put a spotlight on the conflicts we seem to have these days, not just with the rules, but with the refs who try to enforce them. And so I was left to ponder how troubling it is in our culture when there are people out there who really do believe they are the exception to the rules. And to me, that belief is the setup for the lack of respect for the rules and for the people who step into that thankless role to preserve the moral sanctity of them. And what makes this so frustrating is the fact that at one point along the way, we must have all agreed on the rules we end up questioning. Yet rather than just questioning them or looking for ways to change them or improve them, we just love to argue about them. So casuistry offered up this elegant method for hovering above the minutiae and setting aside the principles so we can descend into the particulars. And I really like that concept. But after really thinking about it, if you swap out the word principle with the word rule, and then swap out the word particulars with the word exception, doesn't that just end up bringing us back to the messy intersection where some people stop and some people blow right through? In the context of Malcolm's layered examination of the Jesuit process of tackling these weighty moral issues and how they clash with the worldly approach to dealing with conflicts and areas of life that simply do better when there are rules, I understand how sacred the thinking is when the casuistic method is applied and how no rule or principle is simply discarded because people don't like it anymore. Rather, the emotions have to be neutralized so the greater good and the higher truth can be revealed, and perhaps that's the only way I can truly apply casuistry to my own morality and to my own worldview. Anyway. Toward the end of this same interview with James Martin, he went on to quote Father Jim Keenan, a professor of moral theology at Boston College and the man Malcolm met with when he was in Rome at the beginning of episode 5. And the quote he offers up sincerely altered my life. And it gave me this newfound conviction for how I want to orient myself to this crazy world I live in. But Father Keenan said this, quote, "For Jesus, sin is a failure to bother to love," end quote. Sin isn't a failure to follow the rules. It's a failure to bother to love others. And this love Jesus is talking about is profoundly wide. And when it's applied to the world we live in, it fosters respect, concern, and a dignity that connects us to one another even when we don't have anything in common and even when we don't agree on how things should be done. So maybe if the principle we follow is love, and the particulars and the exceptions are the people, then maybe we can find some space that's created by this casuistic method that allows us to find empathy, grace, and a better way forward that carries us away from the righteous legalism of the rules, but also offers us a place where we can better see the value of other people and all of the truth that's in our midst. Sure, if all of this helps me all that much with the dilemma I had when I saw good old Buttercup breaking the rules by being in the park that night. But I do feel like exploring my thoughts about the rules, the refs, and morality in this way created a level of understanding for how I can take some personal responsibility for my own actions and how important it is to bother to love. And to be fair, when it comes to what we teach our kids about the rules as well as the rule breakers who live among us, maybe the importance of bothering to love is the best thing we can teach them, as well as model to those around us. Anyway, thanks for downloading this episode of Nerd Alert. As always, I've put the links to all of the content I've discussed in my show notes, and
I really do want to acknowledge Michael Lewis, Malcolm Gladwell, and Pushkin Industries for how much they all contributed to my world. Until next time.
Nerd alert, you've been warned.